Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture. What does it take to build a successful consumer brand? And how do you become one of the fastest growing companies in the UK? Today on All About Business, I'm joined by Steve Perez, founder of Global Brands Limited, the company behind drinks brands such as VK. In this episode, we discuss entrepreneurship, resilience after failure, how to build a successful consumer brand, and why Steve believes family businesses still have an important role to play in the future of the UK's economy. Well, today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Steve Perez to the studio. He's the founder and chairman of Global Brands, the independent drinks company he launched in 1997 after, I would say, identifying an opportunity in the market for a new kind of ready-to-drink beverage, leading to the creation of VK. What does VK stand for, Steve?
Well, It kind of stands for vodka kick.
Vodka kick, yeah.
It's vodka with a kick. It's got a little bit of caffeine in it, a little bit of alcohol.
All right.
And it kind of gives you a boost.
So for listeners, we've got a few examples on the table here in the studio, bright coloured, quite enticing looking drinks that you first launched, I believe, in 1997. So, Steve, just going back before that, you worked, I understand, in pubs and bars and restaurants. Mm-hmm. How did you come to start your own business, and how did you end up in this space?
Well, my father was in business. He was an entrepreneur. He had a pub and a restaurant, a very successful pub and restaurant called the Red Line and PKH Hotel, which actually I bought back about 7 years ago.
So where were these places, just so we can
In Derbyshire, in Chesterfield.
And that's where you're from?
And that's where I'm from. That's where all my business is based.
Right.
And my father sadly died when he was just 48. And he was in a partnership, and the partnership all kind of went wrong with him. We ended up with a family dispute. So we basically ended up with very, very little money. So I ended up going to work for the corporate, and I went to work for Tetley & Son, Joshua Tetley & Son, up in Leeds.
And famous brewers?
Yeah, famous brewers. And I was running what they call down there fun pubs.
Right.
And one day my boss said to me...
Well, what was how did you distinguish a fun pub from another pub?
Well, bear in mind, in those days, you know, you go into a pub and you get a pint of bitter or a pint of mild. But right. We sold interesting... we sold lager for a start. We also sold premium bottled beers like Budweiser and Beck's and stuff
so
like that.
So fun pubs had a bit more of a range.
Yeah, loud music and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And a nightclub. My boss told me, he said, you know, Steve, you're doing a fantastic job. You are top manager. You're hitting all the targets. How do you see your future? And I said, well, Jeremy, I want to be like, yeah, well, I want your job. Well, not your actual job, but I want to be an area manager. He said, well, I'm sorry, Steve, you've got no chance. Said, why is that? He said, well, you don't have a degree, do you? Said, no. Do I need a degree? Oh, absolutely. So you have a degree? So yes, I have a degree. Oh, what do you have a degree in? Greek mythology.
So, so this is somehow helpful to me.
I thought that might be
manager.
Quite. That must be useful to run. So he says, I suggest you go and get yourself a degree, and go to night school.
You must have been a bit perplexed at this.
Yes, got to go to night school, get a degree. He says, yeah, and then we can get you on our graduate training course.
Right.
I thought, I didn't really enjoy education that much anyway. So I thought, you know, I don't think this, I'm not going to go anywhere. And I started to think, well, what am I going to do? I had a few ideas. I noticed we were using a lot of veg from prepared veg. So one idea was pre-preparing veg for hotels and restaurants. But then I'd noticed people were starting to drink a lot of premium bottled beers. And I thought, you know what? I reckon I could make a living. And I got no grand desire. All I wanted to do was stop working, you know, for the corporate. You know, used to give me a rollicking because I was 10 minutes late, because I've been working in a nightclub to 3 o'clock in the morning and I wasn't on time at 9:30 and that kind of thing. And
right.
I didn't enjoy working for, you know, and I then thought, yeah, these imported beers are doing quite well. So I managed to borrow a bit of money off my mum and bought myself a little van, a little white van, and started to import small amounts of premium packaged beers. In those days, you know, I had Budweiser. So Budweiser, nobody had heard of Budweiser. And was saying, oh, this is Budweiser. It's from America. Oh, that's cool. And solid. You put a lot. You put a lime in a bottle, and it's really cool.
Yeah, I remember this sort of emerging a long time ago. People started putting limes in bottles.
And
that was your sort of promotion, wasn't it?
I used to say, we don't sell beer, we sell sex. And
that'll get people's attention. So what happened?
because you look a lot cooler, you know, to the opposite sex. Oh, I see.
So if you're drinking one of these,
an expensive bottle of premium beer, whether it be Grolsch or Beck's or Budweiser, then you look like you're what rather than stood there with a pint of bitter in your hand.
Right.
Yeah. So a lot of the guys started to drink premium bottle beers.
Right.
And you also like the dads drank bitter, their dads drank lager, the sons drank premium bottle beers, and their sons drink alcohol.
VK,
hopefully.
So you've got all generations catered for here.
Yeah, then. So that business I built up from, you know, some out the back of a little van.
So this was going around Derbyshire, Yorkshire, area?
Well, initially it was all around Derbyshire and Sheffield, which was the biggest city close to us. Yeah. And one day I got this big account. I kept, in those days, of course, we didn't have mobile phones and you had to keep phoning. And one of the things was I kept phoning this guy. I remember it was Peter Moore and the company was called Midsummer Leisure. He was the area manager, and I presented my beers, my range of beers. I had to speak to him, and he was never available. But I kept calling his office. And one day I thought, I called his office at 6 o'clock at night, and I called the office, and he answered the phone. Oh, Mr. Moore, I needed to speak to you about my premium beers. He said, oh, yeah, I've been meaning to speak to you. Let me give you my order. And he gave me this huge order,
right,
which I could barely afford. And we started to supply this company, Midsummer Leisure, which became European Leisure, and we were supplying premium bottled beers. And this was quite a successful business. We turned over about 10 million for about 10 years. But then what happened, you know, it was a change of government policy.
Talking about now?
This was so 95, 96. So the first business started in 1986.
Right.
By 95, 96, a lot of brewers had cottoned onto the imported beers and started to import the beers directly themselves.
Right.
Not only that, was at that time there was if you remember the whole cross-border shopping thing where guys were going over to the continent with white vans, not paying duty. There was another recession, and in 95, basically 96, my business went bust.
Right.
And I was like, because we got some bad debts, and I was fairly highly geared, and you know.
So you obviously had to buy the beer and then sell it on, and you were the financing.
I was financing. I was doing stuff like, you know, invoice factoring, invoice discounting, to raise funds. And we took a few bad debts. We didn't have a lot of cash, and you know, the bank
that put you under.
Yeah, put me under, and you know, and I thought,
how many people worked for the company then?
About 20 at that time. So
that must have been really tough.
You know, it was probably one of the worst days of my life. You know, I remember coming on the train from London, looking at myself in the bathroom and pointing at myself and saying, failed businessman. Yeah, I just saw myself. Yeah, I looked pretty drawn. I just looked at myself and thought, you're a failure. Because I put my heart and soul into that business. And you could have said it was no fault of my own, or you could have said it was my fault. I didn't really know it. Maybe it was my fault. Yeah, maybe I was incompetent. And that was a problem, of course, when I tried to set up a new business, because I recognised I'd still got a good contacts and when I went to speak to the banks, you know, at best they thought I was incompetent, at worst they thought I was a crook.
Is your organisation prepared for what's coming next? At Reed Talent Solutions, we don't just manage contingent worker programmes and fill roles through our RPO solutions. We future-proof your workforce, from scaling operations to upskilling teams and navigating digital transformation. We are your strategic partner in building resilient, future-ready talent ecosystems. Visit ReedTalentSolutions.com today to discover how we can help your business grow.
And this is when you came up with your next idea.
Yeah, my next idea. Yeah. Well, and, actually, to start with, I started trading because I recognised your grey market stuff. When you're buying like products from abroad, it's legal. Yeah. So despite the fact that we weren't the importer for Budweiser, I could buy it in Holland at a cheaper price and sell it on the market.
Well, that was all when we were in the EU, I guess.
And then we started to sell. What happened with at that time with Alcopops? Alcopops became very, very popular. And then
we're talking mid 90s.
Mid 90s, yeah, yeah. Oh. So 96, 97, 98 became very popular. And then the government got involved and brought in quite a bit of legislation to stop them, the way they advertise these things. And a lot of the brewers and big companies got out of Alcopops, as they were called. There was quite a lot of stock on the market, cheap stock, which I bought the stock, and I could sell it to a lot of my customers, but from the previous business, because I'd built up, you know, it's very important, you know, you build up, despite the fact my first business had gone bust, I'd built up some great customers who became good friends, and they were happy to support me in my new venture. And they were buying these Alcopops, sometimes short-dated, And the only rule I had then was, please pay me really quickly because
So hang on, you've said a lot here that I just want to unpack a little bit. So how long after you were sort of having that moment on the train when you were being so tough on yourself, saying I'm a failed businessman, to starting again? What was the sort of intervening gap? Yeah, talking weeks, days?
Probably a few. Well, to start with, I thought I'm also a farmer. I got a small holding, and I just by the skin of my teeth managed to hang on to the farm, basically because I had so much money on it, the bank weren't interested.
That's one way of surviving a financial crisis, I'm told, yeah.
But I got my farm and I got some veg and I got some chickens. I thought, well, you know what? I can live on the farm. I can grow my own vegetables. I could live quite frugally. And I was sort of thinking about the business. Yeah, this building some sort of business. But then I thought, I'm never going to have a big business again. Yeah, little business would suit me. And I thought, maybe I could do a little bit of trading or what have you. But I had no money, so I got myself a part-time job as a waiter in a restaurant. So at weekends I was working as a waiter because, you know, I still had bills to pay. So I grew my own food. The good thing was, with being a waiter, you got staff dinner.
And tips sometimes, I guess.
Yeah, and tips. My uncle had a market stall in Derby, so I helped him sell leather goods on the market stall. It was all ways of just trying to make some money, and then I built this business up, sort of trading not of my own brands, but then it became more difficult to buy these short dated and you know what I mean by short dated.
Almost
expired sell-by dates.
Yeah.
And it got more difficult to buy stock. So, and then, you know, where all these great ideas are born was in the pub. I was talking to one of my guys. He said, what we should do? Why don't we make our own? Yeah, that's a good idea. And we noticed Red Bull was selling really well at that time. And vodka was selling well. A lot of people were mixing Red Bull and vodka.
Yeah,
that was the drink to have.
Keep you going late at night.
Yeah, you have that all night. So I said, why don't we do a Red Bull vodka? And I noticed from a previous business, the brands that sell well got sort of one or two syllables like Beck's, Bud, Sol. And I thought, I know what I'll do. Let's figure catchy names. So let's have two initials. So VB. So I thought VB, Vodka Bull. So that didn't work because it was already VB Bitter. So I went VB, VC, that's Victoria Cross. VD, obviously could call it that.
No, that
I got
be
VE,
good.
That had connotations with, you know, drugs. And I got to VK. I said, VK, that looks nice.
Literally, you went through V and then the following letter.
Yeah, K. Yeah, K looks nice. V and K, you know, it's all linear. Mark James, who was my only employee at that time, said to me, "What was it called? VK?" I said, "Vodka with a kick. Vodka kick." So it became Vodka Kick. And ultimately, we actually had to drop the name Kick because it was decided by the powers that be that it was sort of promoting irresponsible drinking. So now it's just called VK.
Yes.
And everybody knows what it is.
Yes.
And
so what was your first VK flavour?
So it was VK Blue, but actually...
Which we have on the table, VK Blue.
But at that time, it wasn't actually blue.
Oh, wasn't it?
It was in the blue... Well, it was in the blue bottle. It was called VK Energy.
Right.
And so we weren't allowed to call it. We found that a couple of years later, the powers that be ruled we couldn't call it VK Energy because that could promote irresponsible drinking. So But everybody used to call, because it was wrapped in a blue sleeve, everybody called it VK Blue.
Right.
So let's just call it VK Blue. So for many years, it was sleeved, but it was a sort of Red Bull flake coloured liquid. And so it was only some more recently for environmental reasons, really. We took the sleeving off, the plastic sleeving off. And obviously we had to add some sort of coloured.
Was the sleeving on so people could drink it in various locations? Was that why it was sort of covered up?
It just looks cool.
Just looks really cool.
Yeah, it looks really good.
So you really sort of did a lot of thought around the way it looked and sounded.
Oh, yeah.
That was
your
focus.
I think the thing is with business, you could say 10 years and probably 10 years prior to that in working in hospitality, I realised you've got to give people what they want, and people want to hold a bottle in their hand that's sexy.
Yeah.
And like the beers and Alka Pops were the new
so you wanted a good looking bottle.
Yeah, I wanted something and it looked great. In fact, it was the same colour as my car. I managed to afford a BMW at that time because the business had grew fairly quickly, really.
Was that bright blue?
And that was bright blue. I said, "Do it. Let's make it the same colour as my BMW."
Right. So blue is the colour.
Yeah, it was like a silver blue.
Right, okay. So then you obviously expanded the range.
Well, to start with, we just started with blue and then it was a watermelon. But what happened was, because I got the contacts from my previous business, I got the, we got the blue, we had an orange and a watermelon and an iron brew version. They were the first four flavours. Because actually, you needed a range.
But hang on, Iron Brew is another brand.
No, well, that's spelled Iron Brew. That's IRN. But Iron Brew actually isn't a brand. Not
what
spelled,
is Iron Brew then?
Iron Brew is a tutti frutti flavour, actually.
It's actually a flavour.
Yeah, it's a flavour.
It?
Yeah,
I never
knew
that. So you could use that phrase.
Yeah, we could use that phrase. Yeah, right. Yeah. And at that time, that was quite popular. And I went to my my customers I had from important beers. And I said, "Look, I've got this new brand." The biggest brand at that time was Bacardi Breezer. And I said, "Look, you could kick out Bacardi Breezer and put in VK. And the benefit of VK over Bacardi Breezer is, first of all, it's vodka. It's not rum. People prefer vodka to rum. Our bottle's a little bit smaller. And instead of being 5.4 ABV, the 4% ABV, so less strong, people will drink more. And actually, people will be less ill. You get less problems in your nightclubs. And you save money. It's kind of a win-win."
Right.
As soon as we started to produce it and supply it, the business, we were turning over about, when I first started, we turned over about 200,000. The year we started with VK, we turned over 2 million. The following year, we turned over 16 million.
16. So grow eightfold.
Yeah. The following year, we turned over 30 million. The following year, we turned over 65 million.
This is a huge growth sort of trajectory. That must have put quite a lot of pressure on the business, didn't it?
It was, but you know what?
Did you do that?
Yeah. It was the best fun I've had in my life. It was.
Sounds it.
Talk about, having fun in business.
So you must have had to grow a team pretty quickly.
Yeah, it was fun and fear, having fun. I'm a rally driver, and people are like, "Well, it's dangerous, isn't it?" And I suppose it was dangerous. My house.
You like a bit of adrenaline, buzz.
What was left? Everything was on the line, and people said, "Well, how did you fund it?" And the difficulty with drinks, of course, you have to pay. Well, we had to pay the duty up front. So as soon as we produce, we have to pay the excise duty up front, and we have to pay for the product because it was very difficult getting getting.
So you weren't making it; you were getting other people to make it, were you?
And yeah. And that's what we still do today. Everything, you know, we're a mill without looms. So everything is, our skill set is in marketing, in producing amazing liquids. But the only thing we don't do is put the liquid in the bottle.
You're coming up with the recipes and the marketing.
We supply the labels, we supply the branding, crowns and everything. Yeah. And we supply that to the filler, and the filler fills it. You know, lots of the big brands do the same thing, including me. We'd go down the same line as Bacardi Breezer, for example, our arch rival. Yeah. So you don't necessarily have to have a factory.
But you had to be able to finance that.
Yeah.
And so that was a challenge, growing that far. How did you do that?
And that is the biggest.
Because you've also got these banks who think you're either incompetent or a crook, as you put it.
Yeah,
So how did you persuade them to finance?
I couldn't borrow any money from the banks. Not only
you couldn't.
They were awful. Because in those days, because you wrote checks. And I remember one day, the bank saying, oh, you wrote overdrawn. I said, well, I'm not overdrawn. I've got all these checks. He said, yeah, but you've got uncleared funds. That means you're overdrawn, so I'm going to have to bounce some of your checks. I said, please don't do that. If you bounce my checks, my suppliers will lose confidence in me and I'll be out of business again. He says, no, look, I need $5,000 in your account by today. Meanwhile, actually, I was negotiating.
You had checks from other people.
So
it would take days to sort of administer or process.
For those people who don't know what checks are, those are pieces of paper we used to have to write.
Yeah, but they took like 2 or 3 days to take, which was while they were making money out of your money, I guess.
Yeah.
So and they were going to put you out of business.
They were going to put me out of business. So
that's shocking.
So I managed to sell my only car. I got a Land Rover, and my farm Land Rover. I sold my Land Rover for cash. Got $5,000 cash. Put it into the bank, and I said, "There's a cash, Chris Rigby was his name. Maybe I can't say his name. Midland Bank in Chesterfield.
Just so everyone knows.
there's a cash, and." Close the effing account. I said, what do you mean? So, no, I've opened an account with Royal Bank of Scotland. So, close the account, clear the checks.
They lost you as a customer.
Yeah. Got the bus back to my warehouse.
You sold your car.
To stay
in business.
Just to get those checks cleared.
Right.
It was bought for cash. So then what happened? The business was growing so quickly, but I got some really, really good suppliers, and many of which, in fact, Thomas Hardy was our bottler, they were our biggest supplier, and they still 25 years still bottle for us today.
They're still a supplier.
Yeah, they're still suppliers.
So that relationship's critical.
And they're probably our biggest supplier. And I went to Peter Ward, because it was another family business, Chris's father. I said, look, I haven't got the cash yet to pay you terms, but please, if you could, I've only got a $5,000 credit limit, but my business is going really well. Please come to my office, see what we're doing. If you want to see my bank statements, if you want to see my cash book, anything you want to do, you can see. I'll fax them down to you.
Because you knew the money was going to come in.
Yeah, we've got great customers. We're making fantastic margins. We're making huge amount of profit, but we weren't making any cash.
Yeah.
So I went to all my suppliers, my glass suppliers, and said, and to my surprise, they all said, well, nobody's ever said this to us before.
Right.
And you know what? In 25 years in business since, nobody's ever come to me and said, we certainly put people on stop and give them credit limits, but nobody's come and said, I'll show you my books, come and have a look, send your FD along. And
so that's good advice to people who are in this situation of growing businesses and
the
cash is tight, you know, if you've got a growth story to show.
Yeah, and you know what gets me these days? And maybe it wasn't around in when I first started. Business these days, everybody talks about seed enterprise, SEIS, where you give a chunk of your business away to VCTs, and I would say you've got to hang on to your business, and
so find other ways of financing.
Find other ways. That should be the last resort.
Well, equity is your last resort.
Yeah, equity is your last resort. You know, go to the banks at that time. You know, you had to go to the banks. Yeah. And eventually, you come up with a business plan and, the banks lend us money. There's invoice factoring, invoice discount. There are other forms of finance. But But I, you know, I see lots of these businesses around, and some people send me business plans, and they show me the business plan. First of all, the founder's on $150,000 a year, and he gives away a lot of his equity. He loses millions and millions and millions. You know, I look at lots of our competitors. I see lose millions a year, and then they shout out in the press how delighted they are that they've narrowed their losses from 3 million to 2 million, and they're always looking for an exit, and I never built a business to look for an exit. I built a business because I love what I do. I love the people. I love my customers, and it's great fun enjoying your own business. And over the years, many times I've had businesses, VCT or venture capitalists come along and say, "Oh, would you like to take 10 million out of your business? You'd like to take 20 million? Yeah, we'll take a minority stake. You'll still be running your business." And I've always resisted it. Yeah, I run my own show. I don't want somebody.
But why have you resisted it? Because you think they're going to take it over, or because they'll make you sell it, or what's the?
Because it means I can make mistakes.
You can make mistakes when you're your own.
Yeah, I make mistakes all the time. You know, we do things, we try things, we try new brands, and sometimes they're successful and sometimes they fail. And I don't have to look over my shoulder or get permission. And we have to do things very, very quickly. Yeah, drinks business is almost like the fashion business. Things change very, very quickly. Fashions change, flavours change. Yeah, for example, peaches are in flavour right now, so... You know, yuzu is a big flavour right now. So you need
to keep abreast of
these. Yeah, yeah. And you need to move quick. And sometimes you get it wrong. You know, sometimes you're too early to market. We've made that mistake a few times. We've brought brands to market and we think they're going to be really successful, and they failed.
Yes. So having the sort of independence to be able to try things and to weather failure without a venture capitalist coming down on you like a ton of bricks and you miss some plan, it's really important, I can see. How have you developed your product range? Because I know you've gone beyond VK and you do other things now as global brands.
Yeah. So our main market was, to start with, was mainly pubs, clubs, busy town centre bars. So the first brand we came along was called Corkies, which is a flavoured shot, and that was very, very successful. And then we have another brand called Kick, which is a non-alcoholic version of Vodka Kick, and it's another energy drink. About 5 years ago, I bought Hooch. Now, Hooch at one time was our arch rival, and it went off the market. It was originally owned by Bass.
So Hooch was Alka Pop's.
It was another Alka Pop.
That's what I recall. Yeah,
yeah. Many people say it was the founding father of Alka Pops.
The original.
Yeah, it was the original.
Okay. Yeah.
And Coors,
I remember it. Yeah.
Coors had it, and I think Bass had it. And then Coors bought Bass Brewers. I think the Americans just didn't like Alka Pops. Right. Thought they were probably too girly or something, and eventually decided they were going to take it off the market, and it went off the market.
Right.
And I met up with Bass or with Coors as it was then. I said, look, you've got this brand Hooch, and you're not doing anything with it. Would you let me license it? And So we came up with a very, very simple licensing agreement, and for about 10 years we were very successful with Hooch, and we Keith Lemon launched it for us. Keith Lemon Hooch and all that, and then to my surprise, so 3 years ago, Hooch, the owners of Hooch, which was Coors, offered to sell it to me, and I was absolutely delighted. It was the first acquisition I've made, because they'd always said that they wouldn't sell it. It was too big a brand for them, and I bought it, and we brought it into our into our stable. So we've really sort of cornered the let's say the alcohol. Well, we don't like to call it alcopots. We call it RTDs, ready to drink.
Why don't you like to call it alcopots?
Well, it has connotations with unsociable drinking, irresponsible drinking. But actually, a lot of these products are actually not that strong.
So you call it ready to drink?
Ready to
drink. So they're like little cocktails?
Yeah, we supply a range of cocktails called All Shook Up. Now that's in all the major retailers, or a lot of the major retailers. All Shook Up, for example.
Right. Shaken, not stirred.
Yeah, you'll see it in Tesco's.
Right.
And also we supply a lot of own label products for some of the discounters. Right. Such as Aldi and Lidl, and also some of the other major supermarkets. Because what we're absolutely brilliant at is coming up with a fantastic flavour. I really believe our guys,
So you have a sort of taster team, a sort of little laboratory where people are trying these things.
Yeah,
nice job for people.
Yeah, we have our own chefs who come up with flavours. And they are absolutely brilliant at coming up with great flavors and also innovative flavors. You know, so like I said, we've just launched a yuzu flavor of Franklin and Sons, which I can tell you about.
So tell me about Franklin and Sons. Yeah, that's another business line for you.
Yeah. So
what's Franklin and Sons?
So I'd obviously seen the success of Fever Tree, or the growing success of Fever Tree about 10 years ago.
So there was Schweppes.
Yeah, first of all, there was Schweppes.
And then there's Fever Tree.
Yeah, there's Fever Tree.
Well, these are tonics, typically. Yeah. Yeah. And now you've got Franklin and
Sons. Yeah, and I thought, I'd seen Fever Tree, but I just didn't want to invent yet another, Me Too copycat of Fever Tree. But I saw there was a market for another premium tonic. And I looked around, I thought, what a lot of these brands are lacking our heritage, because the great thing about tonics, tonics were invented, in India, it was a tonic, which quinine was
meant to help you avoid malaria.
Malaria, so there's a lot of history. And I looked around, and I scoured the internet, and I found there was a tonic, a soft drinks company called Franklin and Sons, which were originally founded in 1886.
Right,
and the brand had died, gone off the market, and the trademarks had lapsed. And I contacted the original family, the descendants, and asked if they were interested in being involved. Unfortunately, they weren't interested in being involved in the business. I explained I wanted to bring the brand back to life. Which they were very happy did so. And we were true as possible to the brand. So we went back and we tried to find the old recipes and the bottle was very similar in terms of logo to how it was back in the day.
And so this is interesting. So you were very interested in recreating the narrative around an old brand that made a premium product. And recreating, because obviously with VK you did the opposite. You started afresh, something new. Here you're going, right, this is a different strategy marketing wise.
Yeah,
So what made you change?
I tell you what gave.
Why didn't you just do a new tonic?
I tell you what gave me the idea. I was in the Brewers Hall, I think it is. The Brewers Vintners, the Brewers livery, Brewers Vintners or the Brewers Hall, and I was going down the stairs and I saw these wonderful names. I think like Watney's or Edmund Watney or the Charringtons, and all these old brewers, all people.
Yes.
Yeah. I know there's a few around still today.
They're people's names.
The people, Charringtons. Yeah. They're all the original founders. So isn't that wonderful? But there's very few brands like that. So I wanted somebody's name. Yeah, I don't think a tonic called Perez would have worked anyway. By the way,
might have done. That's quite good to me.
Not very British.
No, but tonic isn't, as you just said.
There was actually another brand which I saw called Clayton, which was actually found, which actually soft drinks and company in Chesterfield, but they'd already got trademarks in Australia and various other. So, but I found Franklin's. And then we developed. And what I wanted to do, I wanted to develop something special really for the on-premise, because the problem is what happens with brands is develop these very premium brands, and you know I don't necessarily want to decry my competitors, you know, such a Fever Tray, because I understand the commercial pressures that they're under. You create a really successful brand as they did with Fever Tray, and once again they went into all the premium venues and hotels, but gradually they went out in the supermarkets, and I think once you start to get in the supermarket, they become less special. And also kind of devalued, you know, like it's like, say, champagne. Yeah, like lots of, you know, sommeliers look rather sniffy if you order a bottle of Moët Chandon, because, you know, you can buy it in every supermarket. And it's probably better. Right. There are better champagnes than Moët Chandon. And I also believe that if you're going out for dinner or a cocktail, you want an experience, and you want to experience something you can't experience at home.
I see. So this is for...
So one of the things we've done with Franklin's, we've created a lot of really unusual and different flavours. Yeah, my favourite being a rosemary black olive flavour, which is rosemary black olive flavoured tonic, which is absolutely amazing. Right. And now...
You can only get that when you go out. You can't get it in the supermarket.
Yeah, you can't buy it in the supermarkets. Right. You can buy it online, but you can buy it. And it's something for the bartenders to talk about, because it should be going out should be an experience. It's not like going, you know, anyone can sit at home and have a gin and tonic or a meal, and also as far as the outlets are concerned, if you can buy, you know, that tonic for 50p in a supermarket, well, it looks like you're being ripped off if you're charging, you know, £3.50 for it.
It does.
Yeah.
I know that feeling. It happens. Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. So I can see the strategy, and that makes sense. So let's fast forward a bit here, Steve. So you now have, I believe, a family business, because I think other family members are involved in global brands.
Tell me
how it looks today.
Yeah, well I've sort of... Can I just go back a little bit?
You can do what you like.
Right, yeah. Yeah, because I'm also a hotelier as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I needed to, once my business was expanding, I needed to move offices. So I bought a piece of land. I was making a lot of money then. It was, yeah, a business.
How long ago are we talking about now?
So this would have been in 2000 and, another recession, 2008, 2009. And I decided, you know, I was making so much money, I needed to buy some land and build something. So I decided to build some offices. So I bought a piece of land in Chesterfield, which was quite a big piece of land, but it was too big for my offices. And again, where all the great ideas are born, in the pub. I was talking to my brother. He said, I don't know what else to do with this piece of land. It's a great site. And he said, well, why do you build a hotel? I thought, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's build a hotel. And I started off with a...
So you just had an idea in a pub to build a hotel?
Yeah.
And you went and built one?
And I built a hotel.
this is good. How many bedrooms does this hotel have?
So it started off as a little three-star hotel.
How many rooms?
With about 60 rooms.
It ended, 60? That's not that small, yeah.
At one stage, it ended up looking like something in Dubai.
Right.
And it kind of completely went off budget. But it ended up being 100 bedrooms.
So what's it called?
It's called the... Casa Hotel,
yeah, in
my
Chesterfield.
House. Yeah, yeah, in yeah. Right, and it's a six-story building. It's a beautiful, very modern building. Initially, the planners didn't want it because he said it would look too modern, and I said, look, it's a £20 million development. If you don't want it, I'll move somewhere else.
What's the rival town to Chesterfield? You could have threatened them with.
Where Sheffield's are.
Well,
Yeah. But it's great because what it means is our offices are there on the fifth floor. Mm. My staff can stay there. Look, we have members of staff not only all over the country but all over the world, and they can come. Our customers can come. We can build the drinks, and I can indulge in my other passion, which is the. Which is food and
so it's probably got quite a lively bar, has it?
It's got a great bar,
and a good restaurant. I hope.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to visiting one day. So is it busy? Is it happy with it?
But obviously,
this was a different business though.
Yeah, but as I was building, because the bank said, "Are you crazy? What do you know about hotels?" Well, I know a lot about hotels. My father was in the restaurant business and I worked in hotels. But actually, it was a lot more difficult than that than I imagined. And just while we were building the hotel, we had another recession, and it put a lot of pressure on the business. That kind of 2009, 2010, and many times I regretted building it. But actually, subsequently, it's been very, very popular. It's the only 4-star hotel in Chesterfield.
Right.
But then I decided I liked hotels and I enjoyed the whole. As I said, my father had the Red Lion pub and restaurant, which it became the Peak Edge Hotel. And about 7 years ago, I heard on it was going to, just before COVID, yeah. I'd heard it was on the market and was for sale. So I bought it.
This is also in Chesterfield?
Also, just outside Chesterfield, yeah. And it's about 2 miles from my house. And I'm also a farmer. I've got a 500-acre farm. So my idea has always been, a bit like Jeremy Clarkson, was to build this farm to fork, so I have the animals,
right?
And the animals go to feed the hotels, the hotels serve my drinks,
You're vertically integrated,
exactly.
As business
really old fashioned that vertical
it's old,
integration,
old fashioned, but you seem to think it works. So.
Yeah, it does, and this there's so many synergies. For example, the cocktail barman. Ended up coming over and now works in the drinks business, and so there are lots of synergies there.
And you have your family involved, I understand.
So my son's joined the business, Seb. He's a part time professional racing driver as well.
Right.
So when he's not racing all over the world, he races old cars. He's a very, very successful driver. He won the British Rally Championship, and
good for him.
So what he's able to do is able to look after some of our he's helping looking after some of the international markets. We've got a huge potential right now in the US with Franklin and Sons. I see that as being a great growth area, and also my nephew's working in the business.
Fantastic. So Steve, I understand that when we finish talking here, we're in Chancery Lane in London. You're going to walk round the corner to the High Court, where you have a case that's being heard over the next couple of days, challenging our government about the introduction of, removal of inheritance tax, business property relief. So could you explain what's going on? Why are you bringing this case? What's the issue here? And what do you hope to achieve?
Yeah, for 50 years. Brought in by a Labour government, businesses, family businesses, have been allowed to pass on to the next generation. And there's millions of family businesses in the UK. We're the biggest employer of people in this country. The government, in the first 2 months, changed the business property, whereby all businesses now will have to pay on the death of the founder or owner. Is a 20% on the value of their business. Now, people think, well, you've got a big business, you can afford 20%. But actually, what it is, for example, if you valued any business, let's think of a number. If you valued a business at 50 million, you would have to find 10 million to pay the government. Now, finding 10 million would mean you'd have to pay yourself approximately 20 million pounds in dividends to pay the tax. Now, most businesses...
Because that's already taxed.
That's already taxed, yes.
So, they're basically taking tax twice if you do that.
It's like the farms. Most businesses, like farms, don't have that kind of money available. We don't have liquid cash. What it's meant for me, I mean, I'd planned building another 27 bedrooms. I planned putting a spa in. I'd got a £10 million canning line going in. I've had to scrap all that for the time being.
Because you're concerned about this?
Yeah, because what it would do, it would create a huge issue for my family going forward. The bigger my business is, the bigger problem I'm going to have. And what it will mean is
that. So what you're saying, so I understand you, is you don't really want to grow your business much bigger because it becomes a bigger problem for your descendants?
Oh, yeah. Oh, the brakes are on. The
brakes are on. So you're literally saying you've stopped making these investments.
Yeah.
So if this is a pattern that's being recreated across the country.
But
that's going to undermine any growth plans for the economy, isn't it?
I mean, but it's not just my descendants. People say, well, I'm just looking after my family. My family are my business and my employees. And I'm really concerned about my employees' futures going forward, because should I die and my business gets sold, more than likely it will be sold to a much bigger business. They'll move out of Chesterfield. The employees would be made redundant. And they'll be out of a job. And I sat down with my two Labour politicians and told them, your constituents on my death, right, will probably be out of a job, and you're voting for this.
And these are your local MPs.
My local MPs, Toby Perkins and Louise Sanderson Jones, have sat down there. And actually, to be honest, I think they agree with me. I think they understand the problem. But the Chancellor, a naive Chancellor, this was brought in 2 months after they were elected, and I spoke to Keir Starmer 2 days prior to the election and said, sir, I'm very concerned about two things. First of all, there's buttes of in the press about changes to inheritance tax for businesses such as mine and also business rates. He said, Steve, we've listened to business, we've engaged with business, and you have nothing to fear from Labour. I thought, well, maybe he's right. We didn't do too...
So he said that to your face?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And I thought, actually, we didn't do too badly under Blair. My business was built under Blair. I wasn't too worried. And this came like a bombshell. There's been no consultation. Unlike, say... Yeah, even the private schools. I mean,
that was in the manifesto.
At least that was in the manifesto. No. This wasn't in the manifesto. There was no consultation, and by law and by convention, the government are obliged to consult with business for any major changes to tax regulation, and this will have a huge, huge impact on all businesses. Impact on employees. And you think that this government are spending a lot of time talking about employees, welfare changes, a lot of changes to Employment Rights Acts. Well, this will affect employees' job security. Millions of people's job security are going to be affected by this, and they just haven't considered the implications have not been fully considered. And I'm really hoping that the eminent judges, the learned judges, will understand this is wrong and ask the government to go back and let industry consult and hopefully have a change.
So you've undertaken what's called, you've requested a judicial review, which is about to occur.
Yes.
So the judge could say, hang on a minute, to the government, you need to have another look at that. That's what you're hoping will happen.
Yeah, that's.
I mean,
that's,
is that likely? Hoping. Because I mean, Parliament decides the law, rather. Is that ultimately?
No.
Hasn't this been voted for?
So this isn't about a change of the law. This is the fact that the government are obliged to consult. So we're not.
So it's a tax change that hasn't been consulted on.
It's not. You can't.
That's your case.
Yeah, you can't. You can't go to a judicial review because they've changed the law.
No.
But you can go to a judicial review that the process of a correct process hasn't been followed.
Right, because this change will be effective from the beginning of April.
It will, yeah.
And it will affect all family businesses.
And my worry is that what's going to happen, you're going to see family businesses being sold, people being made redundant. There's going to be lots of press. And once again, the government will go, oh, we've got it wrong. Let's have a U-turn. And I really think that's what's going to happen, because in lots of ways, the government talk about growth, investment, and actually this is absolute opposite to growth.
Well, I'm very struck by you saying you've made specific decisions not to make investments. There were two or three things there that you said would have delivered growth and more jobs that you decided not to do because you had this sword of Damocles potentially hanging over your business, where you'd have to find a huge sum, or your son or your children or wife or whatever would have to find huge amounts of money.
Yeah,
to pay your inheritance.
Yeah, I'm hanging on. I'm hanging on with the hope that we'll have a change of government or change of policy, and then at least we're going to be in a position whereby you can, right, great. Now,
well, it's interesting to me that this was originally introduced, as you said, 50 years ago by a Labour government, by Dennis Healey.
Dennis Healey, yeah, absolutely.
So he could see this problem.
Yeah, he could.
And it obviously wasn't changed by the Blair government. Gordon Brown and Tony Blair left it in place. They could probably see this problem.
Yeah, successive governments have not changed it. When I've spoken to former Conservative ministers, they've said, yeah, the civil servants have often brought this up and said, oh, there's these billions and billions of pounds worth of money. Billions of pounds tied up in these family businesses that get passed from year to year. And it's just passed on from generation to generation, and we could be having part of that, and it's not fair. And you know what? I can understand there is a logic to say, well, why should my son or your son or anybody inherit this business? They haven't worked in the business for 40 years and built the business up. But that's not the point. The point is this is a business is its own entity. The business isn't about the people, you know, about the owners of the business. It's about the people who live and work in it, and what this will do will have, and if the business is allowed to continue and flourish, it will continue to pay corporation tax. It will continue to pay other taxes. The chances are, if a business gets sold, it will get sold offshore, and all the taxes and corporation tax will get, like it would be another Amazon or Starbucks, it will get paid
somewhere else.
That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, so that's the danger. So, well, I'll be very interested to see what happens as a result of the case.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed, we'll probably find out by the time this podcast is aired.
Okay, well, we'll follow that with great interest. In terms of your business, I mean, have you really put your plans on hold, or have you got other sort of things you're going to be doing because of this? I mean, it sounded a bit like that from what you just said.
Well, so in terms of investment, in terms of capital investment, I've put plans on hold. But yeah, I'm a creative person. You know, you can't really, I can't be put in the box. You know,
I can see that. I'm imagining that might be hard to keep it on hold for too long.
Yeah, so I'm like checking the box. So I'm full of, and also I've built up a fantastic team. And the key thing is build up a team of people who are better than yourself. Don't build up people who you can tell what to do. Or, you know, I've got a better marketing director than me, Mark Bulgrove. I've got a better MD and sales director. Julian Atkins. I've got a better FD. I've got a better sales director. And I learn from them. We all learn from each other. And so what we're doing, we're creating new brands. We're building. We continue to do that. We can't stop. And actually, to stay in business, you've got to keep moving anyway. Because if we just stop doing anything,
the show goes on.
Absolutely,
you keep reinventing yourself.
Well, I'm
very pleased to hear that. So, well, thank you very much for coming in to talk to me, Steve, today. I've learned a lot about the drinks business especially, but also several other areas. And congratulations on building such a successful company and from turning a failure into success. That first business journey was clearly an important part of your life lesson.
Yeah.
And thank you for talking so candidly about that, because I think in this country, people aren't as open about failure as they are in the United States. And it's a very important teacher. So one of the messages I like is failure is not a buffer. It's a signpost. Mm. And it's suggesting to send us in a slightly different direction, which you did spectacularly successfully. So thank you, Steve. I asked two questions at the end, which I ask all my guests. The first, because at Reed we love Mondays, is what gets you up on a Monday morning?
Well, I love Mondays. It's best day of the week, because I always go for a walk with my dog around the farm first thing in the morning, and that's a day I can speak to my MD of the hotels, ask how the weekend's been. I then start to I'm excited about see what happened last week. All the sales teams sending their successors, so I can't wait to read the successors. And the great thing about Mondays, you've got so much to do ahead of you. When you get to Friday, you think, oh, there's so many things I wanted to do this Friday and I've got to wait till Monday. So there's lots of things going on Monday.
Those weekends, they're so annoying, aren't they, Steve? and then the last question is, this is from my interview book, Why You, is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Well, hopefully I'm still here. And hope, you know, because it's very important I'm still here with what the government are trying to do. Hopefully, yeah, my son's taking a more important stage in the business. And we're expanding in the US, where I'm very, very excited about. And I want to make my business a bigger place and a better place for me, my team, you know, a real family business. And one thing's for sure, we will be a privately owned family business. I'm not selling out.
You said something before we sat down that really struck me. You said a lifetime isn't enough to build a business. Is that how you feel? You want to take longer than that? I mean, is it a multi-generational effort?
Yeah.
Is that how you see it?
Or? Yeah, your lifetime isn't enough. You kind of, right, especially if you start from scratch, unless you're really lucky and you have some great tech idea. You've got to build your business, and then hopefully the next generation will take the business to the next stage, because the difficulty is, you know, as an entrepreneur, very often entrepreneurs aren't necessarily great at running corporates, and you have to metamorphosize. And the second generation hopefully will build it. It's hard to build a business in one generation, because you spend a lot of years. As I said earlier, you have to have 10 years learning and going bust and starting again. And the thing is about a private, independent family business, you invest in the long term. You don't just invest like a PLC invest. We've got to make more profits this year to please the shareholders, otherwise I'll get fired. Whereas a private business, we invest back into the business and continue to do so. And we also think differently about employees, because I think as a family business, what we do is... People often think you're less secure in a family business, but I've had ups and downs in my business, and we hang on to the people. We don't say, oh, we make some cuts and save some money, then that's going to help our share price. You say, well, these are good people. Let's hang on to them, because we'll find a way. They'll help us find a way out of this.
Mm.
And I think then if you've got your family involved in that business, yeah, they're also looking about, well, what's going to happen in 10 years' time? You know, it takes a long time to build. Even brands, you know, VK's been around, you know, 25 years, and it takes, and it's really important to let family businesses flourish in that way. Is it clogs to...
Well, I said clogs to clogs in three generations as a phrase. I was once told.
Yeah,
you said
a different
one.
Back to Cooley again. Is Cooley the Chinese
to
Taipan version.
To Cooley again. That's the Chinese version.
And you know, hopefully, yeah, my son, my family will take it, you know, to the next day. So it'll be a huge drinks business, multinational drinks.
Yeah, he has some pressure to become a Taipan, I can see.
Hopefully he's got the ambition to do so.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Steve. Thanks for coming in. And we won't drink all these at once. Cheers. Thank you, Steve, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Global Brands or Reed, you'll find links in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.